Welcome to the future of Louisville Cardinal basketball right here. This is our family that we're going to embrace. This person has to represent the highest in integrity in athletics and in life. Please join me in welcoming our next men's head basketball coach at the University of Louisville, Mr. Chris Mack.
Welcome to the next episode of What's Next with Eric Wood. Our next guest is relatively new to the Louisville area, but has quickly become one of my good friends and is doing great things at the University of Louisville, and that's Chris Mack. Chris is the head men's basketball coach at Louisville, taking over the job in 2018, and he is a phenomenal person. He graduated from St. Xavier High School in Cincinnati and played basketball for Evansville and Xavier from 1988 to 1993. After his playing days, he became a coach, eventually spending almost a decade as head coach at Xavier before moving down to Louisville and actually moving into my neighborhood down here. On this podcast, Chris and I talk about his journey in coaching, leading him to now the University of Louisville. We talk about his top leadership qualities in an individual. We talk about the core values of his team and much more. We even get into the real athlete of the family, his wife, Christy, a Louisville native herself, former Miss Kentucky basketball, and she played at the University of Dayton. Finally, remember to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. It really does go a long way in helping us produce great content for you week in and week out. Now, enjoy the show.
Coach Mack, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Eric. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming on. And I reached out to your wife yesterday, and I was asking her some questions I should ask you and how you're holding up during this quarantine time and this COVID time. And she responded, "So every once in a while, Chris takes a break from Zoom meetings, recruiting calls, and whatever else he's doing in that office, and he'll go out in the driveway and shoot. And I don't mean a game of horse either. I'm talking like we all did back in the day when we were 16. He'll do a play-by-play of him hitting that game winner, getting that tryout with the Cleveland Cavaliers. Then reality hits, and an hour later, he's icing multiple body parts." She also said, "He's now realizing that I'm Susie Homemaker too, cooking every night, fridge packed with snacks, and I'm even making dips every day to snack on. I really do need him to go back to work, LOL." I'm like, that is perfect, Chrissy. I've seen her walking the dog more in the past few weeks. It's been a good time.
It's number one, I don't know how close that is to reality, Eric. I think that's her version of the truth. I won't lie. I'll go out in the driveway and take a few jump shots. I don't know if I'm actually counting down 3, 2, 1, like I'm in the NBA playoffs or trying to garner a tryout. But, you know, I still have a little bit of shooting touch on the outside hoop and all that Susie Homemaker stuff. That's not true. We're eating more Papa John's and carry out than anybody.
That's hilarious. So you grew up in Cincinnati, big Bengals Reds fan, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm rocking the red sweatshirt.
Oh, yeah, I see that.
And then everyone knows you grew up playing basketball. Did you grow up playing other sports?
Yeah, I did. I mean, you know, I think today you got kids that specialize and you know, quite honestly, it's just because of the schedules that those club teams and grade school teams keep. You know, it was much different than when I grew up. You know, you only really practiced your sport during that season, you know, so I grew up playing soccer, basketball, baseball, probably no different than a lot of other kids. And any free time we had, you know, we were going to a sand lot or we were going to a baseball at diamond at the park or shooting baskets. I mean, just you sort of did what was in the season.
Yeah, no doubt. Do you try and recruit kids nowadays that play multiple sports? I know with AAU basketball, that all these high school kids that want to get recruited at a high level, they pretty much have to play on this AAU circuit, which eliminates a lot of that. But do you like kids that play multiple sports, or does it not really matter at this?
I do, Eric, but I think it's like finding a needle in a haystack. You know, there aren't a lot of kids that play multiple sports, you know, especially like the basketball and baseball. I think probably the biggest combination that I'll see is kids that play both football and basketball. And, you know, generally by the time that we start recruiting them when they're, you know, sophomores, juniors in high school, they've made that decision when they were an eighth grader or a freshman to quit playing football. And, you know, it's always interesting as to why. Sometimes it's just kid doesn't like football practice. You know, I just like the games. Sometimes it's, you know, my mom and dad, you know, really wanted me to sort of settle in on one. Sometimes you get that kid that's got a little pang of regret and was like, you know, I'm thinking about playing again as a senior. So it's just all over the place. But I would say the two sports that get connected the most to those, you know, multi-sport athletes are usually football and basketball. And I don't see a lot of other sports with basketball. Not a lot of basketball, soccer, or, you know, like I said, baseball. I grew up with so many guys that played baseball, football, and basketball. I can't tell you the last time I've seen a kid that's done that.
Yeah, when I think about your Louisville team from last year, I would have loved to have seen Aiden Agahan on a football field. Dwayne Sutton, I mean, as tough as he is, type of leader he is. I mean, you think back of those kids, I mean, they could have dominated on a football field. A lot of them could. When I talk to college football coaches, a lot of them want to see a football player that played basketball because they want to see his athleticism.
Right.
Sometimes in basketball, you don't want to go out and take that contact because you're only one play away, as we both know, with the injuries we've been through in our careers. And I'll use that as a segue. Tell us about your college basketball career personally.
It's really a tale of two different, you know, careers or two different times at the college level. You know, when I got to make that decision, I chose the University of Evansville. Didn't know anything about the school. You know, recruitment was much different back then. You sort of went on your few official visits and decided, you know, you didn't put out a list. You didn't do any of that stuff. And so I went to the University of Evansville because the head coach at the time, you know, really Jim Cruz, you know, really spearheaded the recruitment. I really didn't talk to anybody else on the staff, and just he was younger. I felt a connection. And, you know, I had a great time on my official visit and said, hey, I guess this is the place I want to go to. And so those first 2 years before I transferred to Xavier, I was a 2-year starter. You know, I played 34, 35 minutes a game. I didn't know anything, but, you know, we won. We went to the NCAA tournament. But the experience was something that I wasn't ready for. I'll put it that way. You know, Coach Cruz was a disciplinarian. He was a disciple of Bobby Knight. There was a lot of foul language. I mean, it was very, very confrontational. And I just wasn't ready for it. You know, had I been, you know, what I know now, I think it would have been a lot easier. But at the time, I had come from St. X High School. I played for Dick Burning, who coached my dad, you know, when my dad's team went to the state championship. So the worst thing I ever heard at a practice in high school, Eric, was Hell's Bells, you know. And so, you know, when I got to Evansville, man, it was a culture shock on the practice court. And, you know, just after 2 years, it wasn't a great experience. Even though I love my teammates, I love the school, I decided to transfer. You know, I had scored 600 or so points into my first 2 years and, you know, really wanted to become, you know, like you did, a professional athlete. Transfer to Xavier. I sit out my entire, you know, residence year that you have to do during your redshirt year. And I got a lot better. I got in the best shape of my life. And when I was eligible, you know, I was named captain before ever playing a game. I think we had an exhibition game or a inter-squad scrimmage, and I had like 38 points. I really thought I was, you know, going to be, you know, on my way to having the type of career that I always envisioned. And eight seconds into our first exhibition game at the Cincinnati Gardens, ball gets tipped, a player on the wing for a team from Portugal drives it. I cut him off, take a charge. And in the process, I felt my knee do something really wild and shift out and you know, crumpled to the floor. And, you know, a few minutes later, we're back in the training room and I hear the doctor whispering ACL. And that was really before there weren't a lot of experienced athletes or experienced, ACL wasn't as you know, pronounced and known about as it is now.
Yeah, was that when they still casted it up?
That was the option. And we decided, you know, doing our own research that, you know, Steve Kerr and Danny Manning had done, you know, something different, you know, in terms of recovery and the type of surgery. But those are really the only athletes that I ever heard about that had ACLs. And so it was a tough time in my life. And, you know, so I've gone from my sit out transfer year to now having to sit out another year, you know, with an ACL recovery. And so by the time I got released, it was July before my senior year, my fifth and final year. And wouldn't you know it, playing in a summer league, you know, trying to finally get back 7 months off my last ACL, I go up and block a shot, come down, and my other knee goes out. And that was pretty much it for my career. So you had two completely different experiences. One at Evansville, where I was on the court the entire time, and then one at Xavier, where I never got on the court. And so it was tough, and that was probably the hardest thing that I've ever had to deal with in sports.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Is that the most adversity you've dealt with in life? And I mean, how do you deal with that? You know, when you're in college and you're that age, how did you push through that? Because obviously you made it through the other side of it. But how do you push through it at that time?
Well, I mean, you really don't have a choice. You know, you could either feel sorry for yourself or, you know, but I didn't have a choice in terms of trying to continue playing. And that's all I really wanted to do. You know, I was very lucky to have a great family, you know, great parents that served as role models my entire childhood. And so, you know, education wasn't something that was on the back burner. That was synonymous with whatever else I did, you know, and just being a good person and you know, just trying to get through it mentally was probably the toughest. You know, the realization that I wasn't going to be the player that I wanted to be and that I would work for my entire life. So, you know, I tried. I went overseas. You know, I was in Italy for a little bit. And, you know, just two reconstructed knees that early on, you know, couldn't continue playing and had to come back and sort of join the real world. And that was tough. But, you know, I didn't really have any other choice, you know, and, you know, as much as I wanted to continue playing, it wasn't in the cards and God had a different plan. And so, you know, you just sort of had to deal with it. But I'll be less than honest if I said it wasn't the toughest thing I ever had to go through.
Right. And at this current state right now, me and you, we live two doors away. We're less than 100 yards away, but we're recording this via Skype because of this coronavirus that's going on. And a lot of people right now are dealing with the hardest times they've ever had to deal with. They, you know, with sick loved ones and losing businesses, and that's valuable words. And, you know, when I ask you how you push through, and you just say you have to, you have no choice. And that's where people are at right now. And you will get past this time, and it's tough. And it's, you know, sometimes easy for me to say because I have my health right now. We're not worried about where our next meal is coming from, but we do have challenges and everyone's affected by this. But I liked what you said. You have no choice. You just push through. And then at what point did you know that you wanted to get into coaching?
Well, I think everybody that came across me as a player always said, you know, you have an IQ for the game. And they really felt like I was a leader. Again, I was a guy that got voted on as a captain before I ever played in a game for Xavier. It was through my work ethic and my experience during my sit out year that I think my teammates gained that respect. But it's not something, you know, I wasn't born with a clipboard. You know, it's just you feel so connected when you're a part of an athletic team, you know, especially at the level of Division I, you know, where you're in, you know, film and you're on the buses. And you know, I miss that. You know, I really miss that. When it was all over with, when I was in Italy, and it was like, what do I do now? And so, you know, I can't say that I had this master plan of trying to get into coaching. I actually had come back from Slovenia and from Italy, and was working at a like a Blockbuster type of place because my dad says you need to get a job if you're living in our house. Right. And you know, my sister at the time, Eric, was a senior at Macaulay High School, and her coach, Mike Gleason, had heard through the grapevine that I was back from overseas and said to my sister, would Chris be interested in being a JV coach at Macaulay High School? Because he had just lost his JV coach. You know, all of a sudden a guy got a different, you know, role, responsibility or job at his company, didn't have the time. So Mike was sort of coaching JV and coaching varsity and didn't want to do both. And so I remember my sister coming home and said, do you want to coach Macaulay, you know, girls basketball JV. And I remember thinking, are you kidding me? I'm going to coach girls basketball? Like, no way. You know, like, no way. And my dad said, you need to get out of the house more. Go down there and talk to him. So I did. And I accepted the job. I think it paid about $1,200 for the year. And it was probably one of the greatest coaching experiences I've ever had. Wow. We had five freshmen that were moved up to JV. They were really talented kids. And, you know, we ended up going like 18-2. And I thought I was John Wooden. You know, right. I just thought like, this is me, man. You know, like I'm telling this kid to do this and, you know, watch this pick and roll and we're scoring and we're dominating teams and, you know, so conceited and so dumb thinking it was all, you know, my doing. So, here's reality. The next year, when I come back as McCauley's JV coach, Mike Gleason decides to take all five of those freshmen, now sophomores, and move them up to varsity.
Right.
No big deal. No big deal, man. Move them up. You know, like, I'm Coach Mac. You know, this is what I do. We go 4-16 that year. Like, we were pathetic. And I'm going to tell you, that was really the only time I've ever been on a losing team or coached a losing team. And, you know, that was the realization. You better have some players on your team,
right,
that can dribble, pass, shoot the ball. Very, very humbling experience. You know, I'll never forget, we're playing Sycamore, like one of the first games of the season, and we were down like, we held them to like 10 points at halftime. The problem was we had two. We couldn't score. It's a JV game. So anyway, man, that was sort of how I got into it. I eventually went from there after 2 years at McCauley, a rival school in that girls' Catholic league. I know we were on the boys' side. Mm-hmm. You know, they had coached against me. They had watched me coach. And they asked me to be the varsity coach over at Mount Notre Dame High School. And that was really cool because, you know, for the first time, I was in charge of an entire program. You know, you set the tone at the varsity level. You hired your JV coach. You hire your freshman coach. You have an organizational structure. You know, you want your kids that don't play varsity as freshmen to learn a system, a style that by the time they're maybe a junior, they're learning the same language, you know. And so I made a million mistakes, but it was an awesome experience. And, you know, again, I would take my Mount Notre Dame team down to Xavier's practices where I had played, just so that the high school girls could sort of see how serious the Xavier players took practice, the drills they would do, the competitiveness, so that when we were back at Mount Notre Dame, maybe a month later, and we started our practice, that's how I wanted our teams to prepare and to be, you know, into practice and not goof around. And one thing led to another. Skip Prosser was the head coach at the time at Xavier. And after 4 years of doing that and being at Mount Notre Dame, he interviewed me after my third year and didn't hire me. And I didn't burn a bridge. You know, I didn't talk bad about him or anything like that. It just was disappointing. And right. Then lo and behold, a year later, he creates a position director of operations, which everybody has now, but they didn't at the time. And he hired me, and that was in 99. And, you know, I've been college coaching really ever since.
Would you consider Skip Prosser your biggest mentor in the coaching world?
I wouldn't say biggest simply because, you know, there's so many great people that I've either been shoulder to shoulder with or that I've been on the same staff with. He's certainly as influential as anybody that I've ever been around. You know, Coach had a gift. He could treat the guy that, you know, if he went to speak at Elder, for instance, he would treat the guy that was helping him get his, you know, car parked in the right spot the exact same way as he would treat, you know, the president of Wake Forest University or the president of Xavier. He just had a golden touch with people, and very, very down to earth, very well read and intelligent man, and just a great person all around.
I can vouch for him treating the low man on the totem pole in the right way. I went down with a teammate of mine who was getting recruited by Wake Forest when they were number one in the country. So going into my senior year of high school, I go down to this basketball league. At the time, I'm 6'4", 205, but you get measured in basketball shoes. So they measure me at like 6'6". So I think maybe I can grow an inch or two. Maybe I can walk on at Wake Forest one day. You know, they're literally the number one team in the country. I'm not arrogant enough to think I was going to be a – you know, scholarship player there, but I'm thinking, you know, it'd be awesome just go walk on at a place like this. Shoot, maybe I could walk on the football team too. That's where my mindset was as a junior in high school, if that puts this into perspective. But I think I have a pretty good day. Skip Prosser's got roots in Cincinnati, you know, with the Kelsey, Pat Kelsey was down there. So that's why I was there. Well, he grabs me at the end of the night, and I think I have this awesome day. He watched a bunch of our games because of his connections with Elder and all that. So he grabs me at the end of the night and he said, Eric, grab a pizza. You know, let's eat together. And I'm thinking, man, there's all these big time recruits here and he's going to have a bite to eat with me. And he said, Eric, I think you're better suited for a football field. And I said, oh, man, well, that's a shame because I didn't even start as a junior last year on the football team. I said, you're so big and aggressive and you have this big frame. I think you're better suited for a football field. It wasn't necessarily heartbreaking because I wasn't sitting there expecting a scholarship offer from him. But at the same time, I was thinking maybe I could play in some capacity. I don't even start, so I guess I'll just keep working at the cemetery and maybe get a job and my senior year in football and all that. But he treated me so well, and he came to our game. I mean, he just has a way with people, had a way with people, and very fortunate to spend some time with him. Yeah. A lot of people want to get into the coaching world. Quickly, what advice do you have for those types of people? Is it get in any way you can and just work your tail off?
I mean, that's pretty good advice right there. You know, I think everybody has a different story. If you talk to the head coach of the Buffalo Bills, he'd probably have a different story than the head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles, you know? And so I think a big part of it, as you know, Eric, is who do you know that'll give you that foot in the door? But I think that a lot of times, you know, and I talk to, you know, kids all the time that want to get into coaching, or guys that are, you know, getting out of college or a graduate assistant, like, coach, you know, what can I do to get into college coaching? And, you know, I don't think they make the mistake of what to do to get in. I just think that a lot of those guys peter out because they're always looking for their next opportunity, and they're always trying to figure out what the angle is to, like, you know, get to a bigger place. And they lose sight of, like, just kicking ass where you're at, mm-hmm. you know, and being, you know, invaluable. You know, you could be at a Division II junior college as a volunteer assistant. And, you know, it's going to spread like wildfire how good you are if you work your tail off and you separate yourself. You know, you get a couple big time players because you're relentless on the phone. You know, you get kids better in the gym because, you know, you're willing to be in there all hours with them. And it's like, word of mouth is so daggone powerful. You know, the next thing you know, that guy that works like that, you know, gets an opportunity, you know, maybe at the Division I level as a video coordinator. And then he puts together a million projects that are helpful to his head coach and coaching staff. And I just think that so many guys, you know, look to what opportunity they could get and where they're at, that they don't just absolutely kick tail and take names and try to do the best job they can of where they're at.
Yeah, you're an absolute perfect example of that. You take an opportunity at a high school girls job, which was, I'm sure, extremely humbling. You know, you head back to Cincinnati from a college career that unfortunately ended with injuries, but then you hop overseas and then you come back and then you take a girls JV job. Like, that's humbling. But then 10 years later, you're the head coach at Xavier. Your hometown school, your alma mater, it doesn't matter where you're at. Just like you said, kick tail where you're at.
Right.
All you got, and great things will happen. And so I just mentioned your rise through the ranks very quickly, and then you get the head job at Xavier. And when Patino got fired and all that happened, there was a year of transition with Padgett taking over the job, and there was rumors that we were going to go after Chris Mack from Xavier. And I thought, you know, he's a St. X guy who played at Xavier. I can't imagine he'll leave his hometown alma mater to come down here to Louisville. I know Louisville's a bigger program and all that, but it was tough for me to wrap my mind around that. How tough was that decision for you, and what kind of led to all that?
It was extremely difficult. You know, I think there's been, you know, Eric, rumors out there that, you know, I was in conversation with these guys, and I say Louisville for months on end. And, you know, that certainly wasn't the case. You know, it was one of those things where we were having a phenomenal season at Xavier. You know, I had one of the best teams that I ever coached. And, you know, at the end of the year, we lost a heartbreaker against Florida State, a game that we were, you know, leading with about 7-8 minutes to go. And, you know, McCure gets a bogus fourth foul call, and it just sort of goes spiraling down the stretch, and we end up getting bounced out of the tournament. And just gut-wrenching. You know, I had three seniors, really, that had been with me for 4 years, Sean O'Mara, J.P. McCure, and Trayvon Blewett. And then we had added a grad transfer in Karim Cantor, and that was almost like culminating to where we thought we had a legitimate chance to compete in the Final Four and win it all. And so next thing you know, we're on a bus back from Nashville, just heartbroken. And, you know, for me, when Vince had made the call to my agent and then ultimately got in touch with me in the days after, you know, I wasn't in the greatest place in the world, you know, with what had just transpired. And, you know, I always had a fondness for Louisville from afar. You know, just I remember Purvis Ellison and the 86 championship and just what Coach Pitino had done and you know, the recruiting battles that we had, you know, gone to against Louisville didn't last very long. And that was always tough. You know, you put a couple years into a guy like a Ray Spalding, and then at the last second, he's like, I'm going to go to Louisville. You know, knowing that you had offered him 12 months prior, that all that stuff had sort of gone into my thinking. And, you know, it was hard because my family's still in Cincinnati. My mom and dad were 15 minutes from Xavier. But, you know, every once in a while, it's just time. And I don't know how to explain that. But I've been at Xavier and walking those same hallways in Cintas for 15 years. You know, for me, professionally, I never wanted to get, I don't want to say burnt out, but just sort of in a rut at the same place. And I just felt like it was a new challenge, a very difficult one. The cloud and all the stuff that we've had to sort of fight through here over 2 years. You know, there are a lot of people like you, like, why would he take that? But it was more the new challenge and seeing if we could go into the ACC with our coaching staff and, you know, win a national championship. And, you know, I'm not a job hopper. I don't have any desire to be an NBA coach. You know, I'm not looking at my next opportunity. This will be it. You know, whenever that time comes, I can promise you I'm not going to be coaching anywhere else.
Well, that's great news. I love to hear it. And you mentioned you take over a team that a lot of people were saying, why would Coach Mack go down to Louisville when they're in this crazy period of transition with the scandal, take the national title away, no recruiting class, guys transferring because Pitino's leaving, and you take it over. A team that didn't make the NCAA tournament in about a year and a half later, you get them to number one in the country during the regular season this year. What was your first order of business?
I think my first order of business was to connect with the players. I never, you know, I think it's a mistake when a coaching staff or a coach takes over and starts talking about when he gets his type of players in. I just think that's, that's really working against what you have. You know, like how can I be invested in you as a coach if your vision doesn't include me? Right. And so I really wanted those guys to know that I struggled with the decision to leave Xavier, and so I chose to coach the players in that locker room. And although I didn't, you know, recruit a Jordan Wara or I didn't recruit a Malik Williams, that didn't mean that I didn't think they were terrific players and I wasn't excited to coach them and it was going to be, you know, our team and you guys were going to be my players. And I know the media and everybody outside is going to try to say, like, wait till Mack gets his players and his guys in there. But I wanted to really quiet that narrative with the players that were in front of me in that locker room that I talked to before I went out to my you know, introductory press conference. And from that moment on, it was about connecting with the players, getting them to believe in the vision that we had for them, provide some stability, and then, you know, get my coaching staff cemented. And from that point on, it was just about what you would normally do in the spring, only it was 24/7. My family stayed back in Cincinnati for the first 3 months. And so I was literally in my office till 11:30 at night, or, you know, maybe a little bit earlier than that. We'd go grab dinner as a staff or me with a couple assistants. And it was constantly talking about recruiting, constantly talking about, you know, spring workouts and how those will look for our players and just connect with those dudes every single day in the spring. That was really our first order of business when we got there.
That's great. And I feel like all great coaches and great teams, it's crystal clear what's expected of them. You know, when I was in Buffalo for the longest time, it wasn't always clear that Sean McDermott takes over and it's trust the process. Trust the process. Every day we get better, continual growth, and we will make the playoffs. We'll break this drought. And eventually, I think the Buffalo Bills will win a Super Bowl. I've had a bunch of talks with Andy Ketter, your strength coach, who I love, and watching Bob Huggins' teams from afar over the years. He was in West Virginia with him, watching his teams. Now to think that we can get a Coach Mack style coach team with Andy Ketter's boys, you know, the way he builds those guys up in the weight room, like, to me, that's awesome. But in talking to him, you know, he's made it crystal clear that you guys preach tough, together, unbreakable. What's that mean to you?
Well, you know, it's not, we don't want that to just be a motto or a saying. You know, those are our core values, Eric. And I know that, you know, you being in a professional locker room, understand, like, you know, again, having a vision for your players so that they don't feel like, you know, what are we doing today? And so every drill, everything that we preach is really about those three things, you know, not just the physical toughness, which I think is required at you know, the Division I high major level, but most importantly, the mental toughness, you know, and having guys that, you know, don't give in when they're down 8 or 10 points. You know, one of the best teams I ever coached in the NCAA tournament went to an Elite Eight. And, you know, it's funny, it was on the other day, and, you know, we were down 8 with 2 minutes and 40 seconds left. And wow. To be able to, you know, to pull that game out against Arizona and go to the Elite Eight, you have to have some type of mental toughness about you. Things aren't always going to go your way, not just in the course of a game, but the course of a season. And for our coaching staff, things aren't always going to go our way. So I think that, like, we want to make sure that everything that we do is centered around being physically and mentally tough. You know, the together part, you know, is gets tougher and tougher, man. You know, with social media and the deal of, like, look at me now, and sort of the way that if kids don't get it the right way, they hop high school to high school. That's tough to get everybody on the same page. But I think the best teams in the country, the teams that win it all or have a chance to win it all, they play together. And if we can't count on you to make the correct pass, then we're not going to be one of those teams. So just preaching and making sure our players understand that everything that we do in practice is going to be shaped around being a together team is something that we hold dearly. And then, you know, the last part, unbreakable, I think that just sort of, you know, is pretty hopefully understood that, like, hey, you know, you're gonna lose a couple games in a row. Things aren't gonna go your way, and we're gonna make sure those two core values that we talked about don't change because the circumstances around us change. And we're not perfect. You know, for 2 years, you know, we've had our ups and downs, but we're gonna keep trying to live those core values every single day. We're gonna try to recruit to those core values. And, you know, that's what we model in our program and we want in our program. It's us as coaches to keep preaching that and keep working that and weed out what isn't that.
Yeah, that's great. I absolutely love that. With your coaching style, I see how you relate to the players. You relate to them extremely well. You have them over your house. You bring them to your lake house. On the recruiting trail, I've heard recruits say that Chris Mack's the coolest coach in college basketball. That would lead me to think that you're a player's coach. I've also seen you coach at practice, and you have a disciplinary aspect to you as well. How do you combine those two and not lose a player when you get on them, but then also have them respect you enough that, yes, you can have them over your house. We can have a pool party. We can eat pizza and drink Gatorade around my pool, but I'm going to get on you and bust your tail on the court.
See, I think it comes down to, like, I don't understand why you have to be one or the other, Eric.
Right.
I've never understood that. You know, I think that, like, you know, sometimes people that cover our games, they want to have maybe a story to tell or a narrative about the coach and say, like, you know, oh, look at Ryan McMahon, you know, coach, you know, he's got his arm around him, like, he's a player's coach. And then all of a sudden it's like, that's what people think. And I don't understand, like, why you have to be either or. I think in 2020, I think my experience at Evansville, man, he was disciplinarian all the way. There wasn't much of a relationship. You know, he cracked the whip and you did exactly what you were told or you felt the wrath. And I think there's a great thing to that. You know, I think that's a great motivator. I think that you get people to fall in line. But I also think in today's day and age, if that's all you are, then kids are going to transfer. They're not going to believe in who you are. And so my whole thing is, you know, I want to gain relationships with our players so that they know what I'm about. I want to understand who they are and what makes them tick, and how I coach Malik Williams might be a lot different than how I coach Quinn Slezinski. But it's going to start with a relationship. And once I've established that relationship and they know that I have their best interest at heart, then why can't I push their ass? You know, why can't I get into them? You know, why can't I hold them accountable? And so to me, I don't believe in you can only be one or the other, quite honestly.
I think that's a perfect answer. And I've had a lot of conversations with men that, you know, a loving father disciplines his kids. Right. You know, a loving, if people say, why does God allow bad things just to happen to good people? It's like, because he loves them, because he wants them to mature, because he wants them to be whole. Yeah. Well, that's like a basketball player. I want you to be whole. So yes, I'm going to love you. I care about you. I'm going to ask about your family. But in the same sense, I'm not going to let you be lazy ever, because then why are you coming to my program if I'm going to let you get away with it? I think that's a perfect example. And as the head coach of a top program in the country, you're obviously a good leader. What are your top leadership qualities you look for in leaders, maybe within a team or coaches you've looked up to?
Yeah, I think the first thing I would say is just, you know, being yourself and being sincere, being authentic. And, you know, I think that the players can respect that. You know, I'm not going to be perfect. I don't think you have to be a leader. I think they just have to know that you're very, very real and truthful to them. I think a willingness to do the things that you're asking of your players, and I don't mean physically, because God knows I couldn't do anything that I'm asking them to do on the basketball court. But, you know, if I don't have, or I have an air or entitlement about me, and I think that my position is something that allows me just to order people around, well, nobody's going to follow me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think having a willingness to do whatever it takes for the program, is that, you know, putting bags on the bus, or if that's, you know, getting up earlier than other people, I think that your players have to see you willing to do the little things that you're asking of them. And I think every great leader sort of has a vision for his program. You know, like you talked about, having clarity with what you were doing when it was trust the process with the Bills. And so I think those three things to me, Eric, are really, really important. Just being yourself, you know, being willing to do the things that you'd ask of anybody on your team, and then having a vision. I think that's so crucial to be, I think, an effective leader.
I know it'll be really tough to say one, but who is an example of a guy who you've absolutely loved to coach, and why? Or maybe a couple guys. And the reason I ask this is because there's a ton of high school kids in Louisville, Buffalo, around the country that'd be listening to this and would love to hear a head coach of the top, one of the top programs in college basketball, say, here was one of my favorite guys I ever coached and why. And it'd be really valuable for kids and even dads to hear this, to be able to pour into their kids.
Yeah, I think back to J.P. McCura at Xavier. You know, I think about Malik Williams, who I currently have. And to me, one of the things that I really identify with when I love coaching a guy is how competitive he is. You know, like, we're all going to have warts as players. We're all going to have warts as coaches. Mm-hmm. And you can make up for a lot of, you know, lack of what you don't have with how competitive you are, how much it bothers you to lose. You know, and I remember David West, who I had the opportunity to coach at Xavier when I first got into college coaching. David said it, you know, years later when he was a pro, Eric, you know, he talked about, like, win the battle that, that you're in right then. Yeah, there's hundreds of battles throughout the course of the game, you know, and I think everybody gets caught up in that final score. But, you know, for instance, if David West is boxing somebody out, did he win that little battle right there? Or did he get knocked off balance, another guy get the rebound? It's like, you know, to win every single battle. And that, I think that goes into the competitive mindset that guys that I love and have loved to coach, they possess it. And Malik Williams is that way. J.P. McCure is that way. And not to disregard the other kids and say, well, they're not that way. It's just, you're talking about the pinnacle of the guys that I've coached in terms of having that type of attitude.
No doubt. Those are the best. Those are the guys I love to play with as well. And, you know, you always talk at the end of a game, like, that one play didn't decide the game. That missed free throw, it didn't decide the game. There was hundreds of little things that decided the game throughout the game. So I want a guy who's going hard 100% of the time and is competing 100% of the time, because we're going to win more of those little battles. And then at the end of the game, maybe it doesn't come down to a missed field goal or a missed free throw or whatever it is. And we're putting all this blame on something that happened at the end when it could have been tons of little battles throughout the game. And I mentioned high school kids and all these guys from Louisville and Buffalo. That's a lot of our listeners. Jordan Nora, a guy you coached this year from Buffalo. Bills Mafia, when I went out to practice last year.
He had stars in his eyes when you walked out there, man. Like, that dude is such a Buffalo Bills fan. It's incredible.
Hey, when you're from that area, it is ingrained in you. And I would always be like, what's up, Bills Mafia? How you doing, Jordan? When I would see him around. How do you think his game translates to the next level?
I think very well. You know, I think that, you know, when you get to the NBA level, Eric, and unless you're a Kevin Durant, you know, a Kyrie Irving, you know, Steph Curry, you're going to be asked to play a certain type of role. And, you know, Jordan obviously is going to be a guy that spaces the floor, and he is a phenomenal, and you know this, shooter. Right. And I think that only with time and reps will he just continue to get better. The distance going from the college line to the pro line will be minimal change for Jordan. You know, it won't even matter. And I think that he's not going to have to, at that level, necessarily really create his own shot. That's what, you know, the NBA offense and NBA playmakers, which he won't be asked to do, will allow him to space the floor. But let me tell you something, man. He is an NBA level shooter. And I think as he gets in better shape and can show that he can defend his position, and I think the way the NBA is trending, he'll be a power forward in the NBA, which, hell, when I was 15 years old, like Jordan Wara being an NBA power forward, he'd be more of a two-guard or small forward, which he's very fortunate the NBA is trending to being smaller. And I think that he'll have the opportunity to be a space-the-floor guy, be able to shoot the ball from three and defend his position on the other end.
Good deal. Yeah, 1 through 4 in the NBA right now, those guys, half of them are interchangeable. You know, is LeBron playing the 1 or is he playing the 4? It's hard to say. And the team, you know, when Golden State had that crazy run, 1 through 4 could really be pretty interchangeable, besides maybe Draymond Green. You know, he's obviously not playing the 1, but gosh, he passes so well and he shoots so well, he could probably play the 2.
And you know, the thing about Draymond Green, Eric, is he actually played the 5 at times for Golden State. So it's like a guy that, when he was at Michigan State, never played the 5. You know, was alongside of, you know, guys that were taller and played the center position. Now at the ultimate level, you know, not that he was their full-time 5, but at times he played the 5. And so it's just the NBA has changed dramatically over the last 5 to 10 years just with the personnel that's on the floor.
No doubt. Explain to me the time frame recently with you guys being down in North Carolina, getting the news that the ACC tournament's not going to be played, then March Madness, the NCAA tournament is not going to be played. I mean, how tough was it to receive that news? I mean, you put in all this hard work, and I don't mean to undermine the health issues and the business loss and all that. Don't listeners, do not get me wrong in this. But this is something that you worked years for to build up to. This is multiple recruiting classes. This is everything you put into it. How tough is it in that moment?
It was really tough. It was honestly, though, a little bit unbelievable. You know, the things happened and materialized so fast that it's not like you had time to process. This wasn't a thing for like a couple of weeks. They're debating about, you know, holding games, you know, or not holding games with fans and canceling the tournament. This happened within a matter of hours, maybe one day. And so at one point we're preparing to play Syracuse in the ACC tournament thinking, hey, there may or may not be fans. Well, by the, you know, 12 hours later, you know, you go to sleep that night, you wake up by like 1 or 2 o'clock, I'm watching on the TV screen, not only has our game already been canceled and the tournament's been canceled, but now the NCAA tournament's been canceled, and like, when's the plane taking us back to Louisville? I mean, it was just, and you know, with social media, you know, I wasn't the person that was trumpeting all this news to our team. You know, like, I'm gathering our team and I'm consoling them and I'm giving them my perspective, but they already knew walking into the banquet room in the Sheraton in Greensboro that the ACC tournament was canceled and now the NCAA tournament. We gave that news about the ACC tournament being canceled and it was already known. And our players then went back to their rooms in the Sheraton thinking, we'll let you know when we're going to fly back to Louisville. And so I'm meeting with Vince and we're talking about just the logistics. He's updating me on the ACC conference call about, you know, the possibility of what they could do to the tournament And next thing you know, it's scrolling across the screen that the NCAA tournament's been canceled. Wow. So information was definitely out there to the whole world before the people in higher up positions, like myself, like Vince, really had a hand on. It's not like we had this great secret and it got exposed. We didn't know either.
Right.
So we have another meeting, you know, with our team. Fellas, you know, I don't know what to tell you, you know, and again, we all have way more information now, a month later, about how COVID-19 is really affected the entire world. But this was in the beginning stages where it's like, why should some virus or sickness, you know, prevent us from having the greatest sporting event, in my opinion? And it's just, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, but it was tough going through it. I didn't know what to tell our seniors. Other than I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was amazing how it escalated just in a few days. It went from something that could affect America to something that was literally putting us, the entire country, on shutdown. I was going to Vegas for the first weekend of March Madness, going to play some golf, watch games out there. And we were going. And then in a matter of like 8 hours, like, you cannot hop on a plane. Absolutely do not go. That was like a Sunday to Monday prior to the first weekend of March Madness. It absolutely insane. And you guys were ranked number one in the country for a period this year. Hit a down spot in the season, which happens. We talked about it earlier. It happens in any season. When Louisville won the national championship in 2013, they lost two or three games in a row in February. So, you know, you can get on rolls. What were your thoughts on the NCAA tournament for your team this year?
Well, we were really obviously excited. I mean, we were really excited about the ACC tournament. You know, the hard part for us, Eric, was that we had we were dealing with a couple guys that were trying to get off injuries. You know, in David Johnson, which the injury wasn't very well known to the public. You know, he had sort of banged up his knee and had a bone bruise at Virginia in the last couple minutes of the game. Mm-hmm. So we were trying to get him, you know, to get healthy for the ACC tournament. Malik Williams obviously went down with the ankle injury at Florida State and was nowhere near himself at Virginia. And now it would have been about 4 or 5 days later playing in the ACC tournament. So we were excited. You know, we were playing Syracuse, a team that we thought we matched up well with. We certainly had our way with them at home. But, you know, the second game is always going to be different. They're going to make adjustments. But, you know, we felt with David as a playmaker in the high post and the shooting that we had, that, you know, you find yourself maybe playing the ACC semifinals, you know, on a Friday night. And so, again, it came all crashing down. The NCAA tournament, you know, is such a crapshoot, you know, that matchups are a big part of it, your health, how you're playing. But, you know, our team was in a really, really good space. You know, we had the unfortunate ending to our season a year ago, and that generally motivates you and sticks in the back of your mind. And some of the best tournament runs we've ever been on, you know, with the staff that I've had, have been when you've had tough experiences a year before. So we were really looking forward to it, as you can imagine.
Yeah, you mentioned a tough experience. Virginia, the first number one seed to lose to a 16, and then right, the next year they go on and win it. You know, you keep that bad taste in your mouth. And I feel for those guys, and I feel for all of them. I feel for a guy like Ryan McMahon, who was just – you know, dying to go play in the NCAA tournament this year and will never get that experience back. And unlike the spring athletes, those guys are not going to get an opportunity. And that's extremely tough. I feel for those guys. And man, it's very severe circumstances, but this is literally a chapter of a history book now that we're living. And it's absolutely wild. Each week we go through recurring questions with our guests. It's always fun to compare these answers. We have a new question. I'll lead off with that one. You're quarantined in your house right now with just your immediate family. You can add one person that is alive, but it could be anybody, to your quarantine. Who do you add?
Wow. This is going to be a very boring answer. I would add any five-year-old in the country to our house.
Braden.
Because Braden, like, he needs to have a play partner 24 hours a day. And it doesn't really hit you, Eric, when you're at work, you're away from home, you come home and, you know, there's daddy Braden time and then it's, you know, off to bed. But when you're here in your house 24 hours a day and this dude wants to, you know, he wants to wrestle, he wants to play Candyland, he wants to play Minecraft, he needs a snack, he wants to go outside, he wants to go inside. It's like, man, I just need another five-year-old to sit there, because my girls, who are both 13 and 14 years old, they don't have the patience to go 24/7 with this guy. So that may be a boring answer. You know, it would probably be better if I said someone like a Larry Bird or, you know, one of my idols. But, no, the reality is if I had another five-year-old in the house, things would probably be a little easier.
That's hilarious. I gave an answer when I answered this. Me and Leslie ran this by each other first. And then I said one of my buddies who plays guitar, likes to play golf, drinks beer. I was like, but Leslie's probably thinking the same thing. Like, Eric needs to be doing something at all times. So let him just have a buddy join our quarantine. So he and he quits driving me nuts. If you couldn't coach basketball for a living, what would you want to do?
You know, that's a good question. I think that, you know, I think when I retire, whenever that day comes, I may write a book. You know, I would love to do that. You know, just take the time to sort of, you know, collect my thoughts. I don't know what type of genre, man. I've always been a pretty good writer, being able to sort of express my feelings through pen and paper. And, you know, I had a great upbringing and great background in English at St. X High School. And so I really enjoy that. But, you know, hopefully that day will come at some point.
Yeah, like the rest of us, you might not even need a ghostwriter graduating from St. X. As we need ghostwriters when we put out stuff. You mentioned you're a good writer. Are you a reader as well? And what's your favorite book?
Yeah, I really enjoy reading. You know, my favorite book of all time would probably be The Millionaire Next Door by Thomas Stanley. It's not necessarily a story or, you know, it's a really, really good read on, you know, people and the power of investing. And, you know, a lot of people want to, you know, look rich, but not be rich. And it's just an amazing read, a sort of a survey of people, you know, back 20, 25 years ago. You'd be shocked at the amount of people that have become self-made millionaires, but don't look like it. And that's the reason why. So it's a really interesting read.
That's cool. Me and Leslie talk about that often. Some of the wealthiest people we know are often the most unassuming. And then vice versa. There's a lot of people living, maybe not paycheck to paycheck, but they give the aura of the millionaire status. What role does your faith play in your life?
It plays a great role. You know, I really had to lean on it during those tough times when things that like you said, happen to you that are really out of your control. You know, I try not to be too outward and necessarily impart my faith or what I believe to others. I'm not comfortable in that space, but I certainly hopefully have raised my family in a way that they understand that our faith is really, really important. You know, my kids go to a Catholic school. Grew up, my mom was Presbyterian. My dad was Catholic. So I'd go to Sunday or Saturday mass at 4:30. And then we'd go to Sunday church service, you know, on Sunday morning at the Presbyterian College Hill Presbyterian Church. And so I've seen it from all different angles, but, you know, I really believe that Jesus Christ is a huge part or should be a huge part of everybody's life. And hopefully I've imparted that on my kids.
Good deal. What's your favorite restaurant in Louisville?
Oh, man, there's so many good ones. I do enjoy, obviously, going to Jeff Ruby's. You know, I've known, you know, Ruby's restaurants since we were in Cincinnati, which is where I think he first started all his restaurants and still has four of them there. So, you know, a good steak at Ruby's with my family is always really, really enjoyable. But we probably do that once every 3 months. I mean, that's not an everyday type of thing.
No doubt. Your everyday spot we know is Rooster's. And then us both being Cincinnati guys, what's your Skyline Chili order?
Man, I would say that it's my go-to order would be a three-way, two cheese conies with no onions, and a Diet Mountain Dew and a to-go cup. I don't have to look at a menu when I go in, and that's just what I get. But, you know, when you have all this idle time, man, it's I can't eat like that. You know, I'm going to be what you were 3 years ago, man, 300 pounds if I continue to eat like that and not be able to, like, be active and work out as much.
No doubt. That's funny. I have the exact same Skyline order. I don't specify the to-go cup, and I was probably more of a Diet Coke guy than a Dew guy. And I'm not a Diet Coke guy for the calories. It's terrible. I like the burn of the aspartame. I think I know it's terrible for you. I don't drink it very often. That's what we had in the fridge as a kid, and it kind of takes me back to that. But, yeah, I'm a three-way guy, two cheese conies, mustard, no onion. And when my parents split when I was in sixth grade, my mom actually moved right across the street from the Bridgetown skyline.
Oh my goodness.
To me, it's like that was some silver lining in it all, to be able to, you know, be able to walk there. And then we were right next to a UDF, which was incredible as well.
You know, what's funny, Eric, is like you being here in Louisville for so long now, you know, you get, I guarantee, a bunch of people that say that stuff is gross. Like, how can you eat it? And it's like, I really get offended when people, you know, dig on Skyline. And, you know, our kids had gone since they had grown up, you know, their grade school and formative years, going to Skyline after church every Sunday, you know, that I wasn't on a road trip or what have you. And so now we moved to Louisville, and it doesn't quite taste the same, but I've got my kids as strong endorsers that if you go at Skyline and say, I don't know how you can eat that stuff, my kids, you're going to have hell to pay, because Lainey and Haley, like, they will go to their death on Skyline, how good it is. I think they could eat it literally every day.
Yeah, I could too. And I used to look like I did. And same way, it's funny, I had Dave Stone on the podcast, and he talked about when he would preach at Southeast Christian Church on the weekend, if he was ever going to mention Skyline Chili on a Sunday, they wanted him to let the restaurant know, because they were always a little understaffed on Sundays.
Wow.
Because of crowds. But if he mentioned it, it would hit people's brain and they would get flooded after church. And that's what we talk about Skyline after church. That's what you do in Cincinnati. Down here, not as much, unless Dave Stones mentioned it. What was your first car?
A 1988 Buick Regal. And I got it when I transferred back home from Evansville to Xavier. It was that summer. Obviously, I was going to be back in my hometown, 20 years old. My dad felt like, hey, listen, you know, this guy's going to need a car. And I had to strike a certain GPA at Evansville. I did that. And so thought that was the coolest thing on four wheels, man.
That's cool. What was your first job?
True job. I mean, I think we all grew up cutting grass and, you know, shoveling snow. But one that, you know, you actually got a paycheck. Was I worked at Aflac, and you know, the supplemental insurance company, and I did that for about a year, selling different cancer policies and out of work policies, and takes me back, man. That's for sure.
That's cool. Who's the most famous person in your phone?
Wow, besides Eric Wood, you mean?
Just stop. Because I know you got. Wow. Kevin Durant.
I mean, like, probably a couple guys in the NBA, like a Chris Paul. You know, I would say, you know, entertainment wise, probably Kid Rock. But other than that, nobody that I can think of off the top of my head.
I mean, Kid Rock's pretty famous. I mean, that's a big dog.
Yeah, I could always get Bill Murray on a couple calls, but, you know, that would go to Luke first. I don't even think Bill carries a cell phone, so it'd be irrelevant to have his phone number, whatever it is.
That's funny. Last one. What's your favorite movie?
You know, it'd be a battle between, you know, Shawshank Redemption, The Fugitive, and then I think if you went to comedy, it would certainly be like Dumb and Dumber or The Hangover. So, and then overall, growing up, probably Wizard of Oz.
Gotcha. Wizard of Oz with the curveball. I was going to say, we get a lot of Shawshank Redemptions. I mean, there was such a good era of comedy when it was old school Step Brothers. You know, that whole age was incredible. But yeah, the Wizard of Oz threw me off a little bit.
Well, when I was a kid, I just thought that was like, you know, it came on, I think, once a year. This is before we had DVR and, you know, you could call up anything you want on your TV nowadays. This was like once a year, you know, they'd sort of run some airings for or some, you know, promos for it in the days leading up. And it was like, I could not wait for Wizard of Oz to come on when I was, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old. And so that sort of stuck with me all the way through my life.
That's awesome. Coach Mack, I can't thank you enough for your time today. I know you're extremely busy right now. Christy filled me in on how much you guys are truly working in the college. coaches, you know, with recruiting and everything else, it has not stopped. And Zoom calls are great, and these virtual meetings are great, but they're taking up a ton of time. So I truly appreciate your time. You instilled a lot of wisdom into people. Dads will be impacted by this. Guys that want to grow up and play sports, guys that run businesses. I can't thank you enough for your time. Yeah. In fact, this will make.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me, Eric.
Throughout my time in the NFL, I worked with many custom clothing companies, and since retiring from the NFL, I needed a new wardrobe. Hopping into broadcasting, I needed suits, I needed casual clothes. Nothing fit me anymore, and I have worked with no one that is as good as Jordan Yoakum with the Tom James Company. You can get in contact with Jordan at j.yoakum@tomjames.com or simply visit his website, jordanyoakum.com. That's jordanyoakum.com, and schedule an appointment with him. He will take care of you from start to finish, and now he can even do virtual fittings so he can service you nationwide. He would be a great avenue for summer weddings and events for the upcoming season. And because of this pandemic we're in right now, we will probably have the busiest event season of our lives this fall, since everything will likely be postponed until then. And let Jordan Yoakum take care of you. Contact him again at j.yoakum@tomjames.com or jordanyoakum.com. Thank you for listening to What's Next with Eric Wood. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please rate it 5 stars and subscribe. That goes a long way for us with this podcast. Tune in a couple weeks for another new episode.